Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending 11th of February 1923, a man gets electrocuted, the BBC wrecks British engineering, Americans get picky, people put money into a box in Kent, a man sees things, another man sees things in the Versailles Treaty, and yet another man sees obscenity. Oh, and a failed politician writes a book. Not in this episode, for reasons of time, ignorance, or sloth. There's a claim that they've isolated the influenza virus. The Ruhr is still going on. There's still strikes, sabotage, and expulsions. And the Irish government has offered an amnesty to its enemies in the Irish Civil War. I found this in the In Brief section on February 9th, 1923. Walter Shoebridge, railway fireman, was standing on his engine at Norwood Junction yesterday breaking coal when the top of his hammer caught a live overhead wire and he received a severe shock. His head and shoulders were burned and he fell to the ground, fracturing his skull. He was taken to Croydon Hospital and was last night going on favourably. Now, those of you who are familiar with the railways of South London, Norwood, despite its name, is in South London, will have noticed something a bit odd about this. While every line in South London is electrified, they are electrified on the third rail, not overhead. So how come this man has touched the overhead lines? Well, the reason was because there was an overhead line. The London and Brighton and South Coast Railway had electrified a line from a London Bridge to Victoria. And, well, that's how they'd done it. And that's how the guy had ended up being injured. So what happened to it? Well, what happened to it was that when all these companies were merged into one, Southern Railway, the Southern Railway thought, well, we want to standardise things, so they standardised things on the third rail, and in 1929 the overhead lines and gantries were all removed and replaced with third rails. So that's what happened, which is a shame because, as everyone knows, overhead electrification is better than third rail electrification. Well, I think that's true on the basis that if you look at all the high-speed lines in the world, well, none of them are on third rail. And I think in Japan only one line, the very original line in the Tokyo Underground, is on the third line, on the third rail. So I think one you could just about argue free market one, state interference nil. Anyway, things with wires can be problematic, and so can things without wires. The British Broadcasting Company has recently started broadcasting, and it is funded partly by its members who sell, well, wireless sets, as they would have called them in those days, radios as I would call them, and they're the only people, only members of the British Broadcasting Company are allowed to sell wireless sets, as they call them, and the other way is through the licence. If you want to know more about this, please check out the 22nd of October 1922 episode. I hope to have that on the end screen. A link to that on the end screen, but, well, I know what my promises are worth. Anyway, this is from a Mr. Norman F. Edwards, and it's from Wednesday the 7th of February. I suggest that the British Broadcasting Company would overcome a great good deal of prejudice and would successfully benefit their revenue if they could come to some arrangement with the General Post Office by which permission was given to the general public to make their own crystal sets, for instance, on the understanding that they paid so much extra a year with their wireless license tax. Hundreds of boys, in fact thousands of them, find an interest in wireless because it gives them an opportunity of exercising their constructive and mechanical abilities. To them, a foolproof manufactured set offers no delights whatever. The whole question of licences with regard to homemade sets needs revising, and until this is done, I am very much afraid the company, in spite of whatever steps they take to counteract it, would find their revenue far from satisfactory. I'm racking my brains here, but it seems to me there's absolutely no way a homemade wireless set can be legal at this time, or at least it cannot be legal to use it to listen to anything that might be being broadcast. It also seems to me that at this time, wireless sets are the sort of, well, the people, you know, boys, the nerds of the day are the people who are playing around with wireless sets, and that is an important activity and one that should be encouraged. But, well, the BBC is discouraging it. In America, they're having doubts about immigration. This is from Tuesday the 6th. The House of Representatives Immigration Committee has approved the new immigration bill, further restricting the number of foreign persons admissible to the United States. Now, I guess this is part, it hasn't become law yet. Obviously, it would have to go through the Senate. And presumably, if it's a committee, it has to go back to the House of Representatives, the floor of the House of Representatives again, before going to the President. But I guess this is a good way of seeing how the opinion is going in the US. It goes on. The limitation would be to 2% of the number of the particular nationality residents in the United States instead of 3 as at present, and will be based on the census of 1890 instead of that of 1910. The immigration officials estimate that under the proposed law, the number admitted yearly would be 168,000 instead of the present 358,000. That's, it is interesting that 358,000, we'll compare that with, I'm comparing it with the British numbers this year, which was something like 500,000. And given that Britain's population is probably about half what the America's was at the time, what was it at the time? Well, yep, they said 116,000, so that's interesting. That means that there was actually quite low immigration to the United States at the time. It goes on. The census of 1890 was chosen because under it, a greater proportion of the immigrants would come from Northern Europe. The measure contains a provision admitting relatives of citizens of foreign birth and relatives of aliens intending... What's the difference of that? Of relatives of aliens intending to become citizens, okay, when you haven't become a citizen yet. All persons who are not potential citizens are excluded, except those belonging to certain professions. Sort of early example of the point system, I guess. This section is understood to be aimed at the Japanese. Were they wrong? Do you want immigrants from Northern Europe? Discuss. If you do, and please, when you are discussing it, do so with reference to Ulster. It's interesting that the Japanese get a mention here. And of course, in the Second World War, the Japanese Americans will be interned, which... many Americans regard as a disgrace, which is odd because I'm pretty sure in Britain, well, actually I know for a fact, in Britain we interned both the Italians and the Germans, and we never had many qualms about it. In fact, I knew an 18-year-old German, he was 18 years old in 1939, and he was immediately interned and shipped off to Canada to work in a slaughterhouse. They were even divided between the sort of Nazis and non-Nazis. I'm glad to say he was a non-Nazi. And I've always felt he was, I didn't say this to him at the time, but I always felt he was probably the luckiest German alive, certainly the luckiest 18-year-old German alive, because it could have been a lot worse for him. Anyway, you know who would never be beastly to the Japanese? You're right. That's the Kent and Canterbury Hospital Propaganda Committee. This is from Monday the 5th of February, and this is a Captain H.G. James. With reference to your report of the steps which have been taken in London to introduce a system of weekly contributions for the maintenance of the London hospitals, may I describe a system which has recently been introduced into East Kent? Those who wish to support the Kent and Canterbury Hospital undertake to deposit a sum averaging not less than 2 pence a week in a box supplied, and to persuade the members of their family to make such contributions as they may be disposed. In return, the hospital authorities admit to free treatment as in or out patients, box holders and their dependents. A local representative of the fund issues a certificate to the effect that the bearer is a contributor to the fund and is a proper person on financial grounds to receive the benefits of the hospital. Our experience, which extends over 2 years. So that is a very odd phrase, isn't it? A certificate to the effect that the bearer is a contributor to the fund. Fair enough, they paid their dues. And is a proper person on financial grounds. Well, are these the same grounds or different grounds from the contributions in the box? I mean, are they going to say that, well, yes, sir, you've paid your contributions, well done, but you're not a proper person on financial grounds to receive any treatment? I don't think they're doing it. I think this is just a tautology. I think this is, well, he's just repeating it. I hope he's just repeating it. I hope there are no other financial hurdles you have to go through. Anyway, it goes on. Our experience, which extends over 2 years, shows that the weekly contributors are interested primarily in the support of the hospital, although should the need arise, they feel justified in taking advantage of the opportunities provided by this scheme. In the year 1922, over £4,800 was provided by this means, between one half and one third of the total cost of maintenance, by nearly 100 small country towns and villages. Now, by my calculations, 2 pence a week is about 100 pence a year, which is about 1/12 of an ounce of gold, which in today's terms is not a lot of money for hospital care if you're trying to insure yourself for a lot less than you pay, say, Bupa. So I wonder why this would be. Obviously you're not going to get GP services from this, but I wonder if it's simply because in those days there was a lot less that hospitals could do. But if it's not that, well, I don't know. I'm a bit puzzled by that, by what a low sum that is. As you'll perhaps be aware, a lot of the time I spend talking about court cases. And some of them are easier than others. This is on Monday the 5th. When a man was charged at Wilsdon on Saturday with being drunk, he denied the offence and asked that the second constable who assisted in arresting him might be called. The magistrate, on being informed that there was only one policeman concerned in the case, fined the defendant 10 shillings. Being drunk in public may be illegal, but what about invading the ruler? This is also from Monday the 5th, and it's from a J.G. Butcher MP. There are those who denounce the French occupation of the Ruhr as an illegal act and a violation of the Versailles Treaty. Such language appears to me unwarranted. It is worthy of remembrance that the occupation of the Ruhr by the Allies was in May 1921 resolved on by the Supreme Council. Supreme Council of what, I wonder? Anyway, it goes on. As a legitimate act to compel Germany to perform her treaty obligations. And as such, was approved by the House of Commons and would have been carried out had not Germany given the pledges then demanded of her. Well, the fact it's approved by the House of Commons is not actually legal. It's not actually something that's legal under the treaty. I'll point that. Anyway, he goes on. Germany is still, as she was in May 1921, flagrantly in default. It is therefore not open to dispute that if the Allies now determined to occupy the Ruhr, their action would be entirely within their rights under the treaty. Part 8, Section 1, Annex 2, Paragraph 18. It is suggested, however, that the separate action of France is not justified. It is difficult to support the suggestion if regard is had to the language of the relevant paragraph, which authorises such measures as the respective governments may determine to be necessary in the circumstances. I have to say, I think that stretching it, and it's certainly a very vaguely worded clause, having said that, surely any agreement must have, and a treaty is an agreement after all, must have some means of enforcement. And it seems to me that by the beginning of 1923, the Allies had actually exhausted all other means. Oh, unless someone can correct me on that. Don't know. Anyway, that's an unclear piece of law. And here's, well, another one. This is from Saturday the 10th. At the London Sessions yesterday, before A.J. Laurie, Guy Alfred Aldred and Rose Whitcop Aldred, appealed against an order by Mr. Boyd, the magistrate of West London Police Court, that certain obscene books be destroyed. Sir Richard Muir appeared on behalf of the respondent magistrate, and Mr. Lord Williams, K.C., and Mr. St. John Hutchinson, or maybe that's Mr. St. John Hutchinson, for Mrs. Aldred, Guy Aldred, conducted his own case. Sir Richard Muir said that the order had reference to a pamphlet called Family Limitation. Yes, this is about birth control. He contended that its sale was indiscriminate and that certain passages in the book were obscene in the vulgar sense of the word. The mind boggles. It goes on. Sir Arbuthnot Lane, consulting surgeon at Guy's Hospital, called for the defence, said that in his opinion, limitation of families was not subversive of the morals of society. Right, I'm getting confused here. Is it obscene in what it's saying, in that in it's using naughty words, or that it's referring to naughty bits, or is it that it's obscene because it's talking about birth control? Because that's a bit of a shocker if it is. Well, a shocker to me, anyway. Maybe that is the case. Anyway, he goes on. The pamphlet, in his opinion, did not go further than was necessary, and he could not understand any sane people objecting. Mr. Lord Williams said that the pamphlet was written by Margaret Sanger, a well-known American writer whose books were in circulation all over the world. It would not, if read as a whole, create licentious thoughts to normal persons. So it's not about birth control. Well, I'm really puzzled. Anyway, it goes on. Giving judgment, Mr. Lorry said he was convinced that both Mr. and Mrs. Aldred acted honestly and innocently, and with the best intention, but in the interests of the morals of society, he had no hesitation in saying that the book was obscene, and he had dismissed the appeal with costs. Wow. I mean, there's no on the one hand on the other there with that judgment. It's down the line. And yet, what's the objection? We don't know. There are bits of this report I've missed out, but they don't help you either. And, of course, the question is, when's that going to change? Because it's got to change fairly soon, one would have thought. Some books shouldn't be read. Others need to be treated with caution. Failed politician Winston Churchill, crazy name, crazy guy, he's written a book on his role in the First World War. As yet, it's untitled. It will eventually appear as The World Crisis. Anyway, in this extract, which the Times published on Thursday the 8th, he talks about that moment when they thought, there might be a war coming. The Cabinet on Friday afternoon, July the 24th, sat long revolving the Irish problem. The Buckingham Palace conference had broken down. The disagreements and antagonism seemed as fierce and as hopeless as ever. Yet the margin in dispute upon which such fateful issues hung was inconceivably petty. No, it wasn't. These are big issues. There are big issues about sovereignty and of nationality and of safety and security. And they are almost impossible to find compromises over. Anyway, rant over. Churchill goes on. The discussion, which turned principally upon the boundaries of Fermanagh and Tyrone, had reached its inconclusive end, and the cabinet was about to separate when the quiet, grave tones of Sir Edward Grey's voice were heard reading a document which had just been brought to him from the Foreign Office. It was the Austrian note to Serbia. This is one in which they make some about 25 demands. Anyway, he goes on. This note was clearly an ultimatum, but it was an ultimatum such as had never been penned in modern times. As the reading proceeded, it seemed absolutely impossible that any state in the world could accept it, or that any acceptance, however abject, would satisfy the aggressor. Is that true? I asked myself. One of the issues here is that Churchill's view of history has come to be accepted because he's such a dominant figure and such a good writer. Mind you, the Times at the time thought much the same, so maybe Churchill isn't so off-beam. It goes on. The parishes of Fermanagh and Tyrone faded back into the mists and squalls of Ireland, and a strange light began immediately but by perceptible gradations to fall and grow upon the map of Europe. Well, I have to say, he had a turn of phrase. Anyway, that's all this week. I normally at this point say I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing. That's more truer this week than usual, shall we say. I doubt I'll have anything for various reasons. We'll just have to see how it goes.